Don't pay retail for your diamond engagement ring or gift. Come to cleanorigin.com. We're experts in ecologically friendly lab-grown diamonds. Mention code RADIO10 for 10% off. That's cleanorigin.com online or one of our retail stores.
Hello, Weather Geeks listeners. Thanks for choosing the podcast. Today, we're highlighting the best of geeks with one of our favorite episodes.
Today's guest has been talking about your neck of the woods for over 20 years. Al Roker is America's weatherman, appearing on the Today Show, Nightly News, and a host of other television and news shows over the years. He has a knack for channeling his on-air charisma into many different media, including penning a New York Times bestseller, dishing out award-winning cookbooks, and lending his voice to critically acclaimed movies. Today we'll learn about Al's passion for weather, how he has evolved with the ever-changing media landscape, and how he manages his work-life balance. That's today on the Weather Geeks podcast. Thank you for joining us today, Al.
Hey, Doctor. Thank you so much. It's great being here with you.
Hey, well, we're really excited about the Weather Geeks format. I'm Dr. Marshall Shepard from the University of Georgia, and we have one of the legends of our field today joining us on Weather Geeks, Al Roker. Everyone knows him, and it's America's weatherman. Al, I want to go all over the place today.
Sure.
So I know you have a new book out there, The Ruthless Tide. We're going to get all into that. But before we go there, this is Weather Geeks. How big of a weather geek are you, and how did you end up in weather? Is it something you always wanted to do?
Well, that's the irony of it all, in that I was, like everybody else, I was interested in weather. I watched the Weather Channel. The weather forecasts on my local channels. I grew up in New York City, but I really had no interest or desire to be on TV. The closest thing I came, there was a local weatherman at WNBC in New York. His name was Tex Antoine. And he was not only a weatherman, but he was a meteorologist. He had been in the Air Force during World War II, but he was also an artist. And hosted an art show. And, you know, back in those days, you know, you were a master of all trades.
Right.
And he had a character called Uncle Wethby. And Uncle Wethby was kind of a character that stood up. It was not quite a doll, but it was almost a three-dimensional representation of him, a cartoon version of him. And for the kids in the audience, he would dress Uncle Wethby every evening on the 6 o'clock news. And this is what you're going to have to wear to school. Sometimes Uncle Wethby had a bathing suit and a beach ball. Sometimes he had on a yellow rain slicker. And I was always fascinated by Uncle Wethby because I was a bit of a, I liked to think I was a cartoonist. And so I just was fascinated by that. But then I forgot about it. I went on to go through high school and went to the State University of New York at Oswego, which happens has a top-notch meteorology department.
Yes.
Which I had no interest in whatsoever. However, it was a college roommate of mine told me, take intro to meteorology with this guy, because sometimes he enjoys the fruit of the vine on a Sunday night and doesn't show up for class on Monday. And I thought, that sounds like the kind of class I want to be in. So I took an intro to meteorology class. I took an ecology. That's how old I am. Back then, before it was environmental science, it was ecology.
Oh, we still have a very good ecology program at the University of Georgia. I know your wife is a fellow UGA alum.
And I'm a bulldog.
The Odom School of Ecology is quite well known.
Yes. But again, I took these classes with no plans of using it. And in fact, didn't plan on being on TV. True story, my department chairman in the radio and TV department told me that I had, after I took my first television performance class, he said, "Roker, you have the perfect face for radio." So I didn't think anything of it. And then the end of my sophomore year, they were looking for a weekend weatherman in Syracuse, New York, which is the next biggest city from where my school was. And he put me up for the job. I did a tape at school. He took it down. And because it was a small station, and he said, "Listen," the news director said, "I can afford to pay you $10 a newscast." Now, there were four newscasts on the weekend. That's 40 bucks. I'm thinking, yes, I'm rolling it, and I'll just do this until I find something else.
And now, what was it like that? What was it like doing a weather presentation at that time as compared to now? I mean, I imagine it was pretty rudimentary.
It was pretty rudimentary. Back then, we would get two satellite loops, black and white satellite loops, that were, by the time they came in, were already about 8 hours old. And they came down our network feed. We were a CBS affiliate. So there'd be one for the morning / noon newscast and one for the evening newscast. And our maps were, at the time, magnetic. They had been painted, and you had put symbols on them, and the temperatures with magnetic numbers that were cut out of this flexible magnetic material. And that was about, you had a chroma key, and usually that's what you had your satellite loop in, again, black and white, and that was it. And you did your maps, and we had a somewhat sophisticated system of sliding maps, but that was a pretty simple presentation compared to today.
Now, how much? I know I often talk to a lot of colleagues in the broadcast side, and they always complain about time for the weathercast. How much time did you have?
Well, it's funny you bring that up, because looking back at it, sure, you didn't think you got enough time, but at 11 o'clock we would get 3 minutes. Three and a half minutes sometimes. It was a lot of time. And by today's standards, it's not a lot, but it's still more than a lot of local TV weather people get. Although, depending on the market and how important they feel weather is, some places get more than that.
Exactly. That's what I think it does vary by market. Now, so you're at this station, you're kind of getting your feet wet. Somewhere along the way, there was this jump into more of the national market. Talk to us a little bit about that transition.
Well, at the end of I was still in school. And so at the end of my I graduated, and 6 months into it, I had gotten the weekday weather job because the weekday weather guy was not well liked, and they replaced me with him. And 6 months in, I got a call from this news director in Washington, D.C. at WTTG. Then it was Metro Media, now Fox. And he said, I'm hearing good things about you. Would you be interested in coming down and, seeing if you'd be the right fit? So I did. And I was so naive. This is before you had an agent or anything like that. He said, listen, right. I can't pay you a lot, but you will be on the number one newscast at 10 o'clock if you take this job. And I thought, wow, that would be great. Wow, that's fantastic. So I took the job, and about a week into the job, I realized they were the only newscast on at 10 o'clock. But, it was honing your craft in a major market. And the other thing that made it significant was that I was to meet a person who would have a massive impact on my career and on my personal life, and that was Willard Scott. He was at WRC. And he was the biggest thing in Washington other than the Washington Monument. And he kind of took me under his wing, and he mentored me. And he gave me my two best bits of advice, and I still, to this day, follow. He said, one, always be yourself, because that's the only person you've got, and they can do whatever they want with you, but they can't take that away from you. And two, never give up your day job. And by that he meant, look, no matter what else you do, the Today Show is your main gig. And that's everything else springs from that.
That's a really interesting piece of advice, because I've been told something very similar. As you know, I'm a professor at the University of Georgia. Right. I do all of these other things with the Weather Channel and Forbes, but I resonate with that bit of advice as well. So I'm glad to hear such a legendary figure as yourself got similar advice.
Yeah, and it really encapsulates everything, and it really translates to your personal life as well as your professional life. So I just had lunch with Willard 2 weeks ago, and he's doing well.
Oh, wow. I think I saw some of that in your social media.
Yeah, he just turned 84, and he's doing great.
Yeah, make sure you're following Al Roker and all of his social media platforms. He's very good and active out there in social media. Now, I want to get back to something you said, because as you were sort of being groomed for this next position, you said that he said that they're hearing good things about you. If you were to look back on your career, what do you think it was about what you were doing or what you brought to the table that was starting to attract people at that time to who you were and your capability?
That's kind of like you love sausage, but you don't really want to see how it's made. but uh, I don't know. I don't think I took, and I still don't take myself that seriously. To be perfectly honest, I don't ever call myself a meteorologist. I'm a weather person. I've learned enough over the years doing it to give a credible presentation. But I have a respect for the material, and I try not to let that get in. I always try to remember that the weather is the most important thing. But let's have a good time if we can. If the weather is such that, you know, it's not life and death, it's not, you know, the end of the world, then, you know, let's not get too crazy about it.
Let's stay right there for a second, because that's even now a discussion. And, you know, I hear people and there are discussions about, oh, he's not a meteorologist. He is a meteorologist. But the point you're making is you know enough that you connect with people, you have the right personality, and you get the message across. What are your thoughts on this whole sort of debate out there, even contemporarily, in terms of what it takes to communicate the message?
Well, look, I think you can be the greatest meteorologist in the world, but if you can't communicate that, nobody's going to hear your message. I'm very fortunate in that we have at the Today Show and NBC News. I will take my off-air meteorologist and graphic folks pound for pound over any other staff in television staff in the country. I've got just a terrific team, starting with our senior producer, this woman, Erin McGarry. We've got an alumnus from the Weather Channel, Sherry Pugh. Got a guy, Don Sunikis, who has been at the Today Show for over 25 years. I got another guy, Kevin Corvo, who's an amazing meteorologist. We got a great guy named Brian Van Aken, who is hands down first of all, he's a great meteorologist, but he is probably the person who can make, not to get too into the weeds, but our graphics unit is called a WSI Max. This guy can do stuff with this that nobody else can. And I think, and my humble opinion, our graphic presentation on the Today Show is hands down better than anybody else's. From our huge video wall to the graphics we use. And so I've got an amazing team backing me up. I may not know all the answers, but I've got people who do. And they give me that information, and I can convey it. And if you can't convey that, if you're not excited about it, if you're not passionate about it, if you don't, you know, revel in new technology and new ways of graphically presenting the weather, you're going to get left behind. You know, because let's face it, we all know right now, anybody can pick up their phone and get the weather. But that app doesn't give you context. It doesn't give you meaning. It doesn't break it down for you to a certain extent of why, okay, it says this, but this is why it might not happen, or it might happen, or it could be worse. Those are the things that we do that I think, because of the people I have backing me up, I think on NBC News, we do better than anybody else, Weather Channel notwithstanding.
And I know that you've had some work with the Weather Channel. We're talking with Al Roker, legendary, what we call America's weatherman, here on Weather Geeks Podcast.
Don't pay retail for your diamond engagement ring or gift. Come to CleanOrigin.com. Founded by a leading family in the diamond industry for more than a century, we're experts in lab-grown diamonds because that's all we do. Clean Origin, the only diamond jewelers who give you a 100-day, no-questions-asked return on your purchase. Head to CleanOrigin.com or one of our retail stores and mention code RADIO10 for an additional 10% off your purchase. That's CleanOrigin.com, code RADIO10.
And welcome back to the Weather Geeks Podcast. I'm Dr. Marshall Shepard from the University of Georgia, talking with Al Roker. Al, you really have inspired many people. I think people tune into you on the Today Show and many of your other platforms. Now, you were talking about how you ended up at Washington, D.C., and ultimately through your partnership, mentorship, and friendship with Willard Scott, who served as a mentor, you ended up there at the Today Show at NBC, nationally televised. Yeah,
along with stops in Cleveland and then finally New York City at WNBC, which was a dream come true because I'm from New York City. And I would, you know, my parents couldn't see me. You know, and let's face it, we always do stuff because of our parents. We want to make our parents
That's
proud.
Right. That's
and,
right.
And I remember when I got my first job in Syracuse, it was on Channel 5. And I called my mom and I said, Mom, I got a job on TV. And she said, that's amazing. What channel is it? I said, well, Mom, you can't see it because you're in New York City. And this is Syracuse, New York. It's about 200 miles away. And she said, well, what channel? I said, well, it's Channel 5. She goes, you're wrong. We have Channel 5 here in New York. I said, yeah, but Mom, it's a different Channel 5. a five's a five. It has to be. It's the same channel. It's Channel 5. I said, no, but Mom, the signal of Channel 5, WHEN-TV in Syracuse, New York, can't get down to New York City. Oh, it has to because I'm looking at, hold on, I'm going to put it on right now. No, Mom, that's WNEW-TV. She said, but it's Channel 5. And it was like a bad Abbott and Costello routine, you know? And so when I got the job in 1983 and Dr. Frank Field was the main weather guy and I was going to be his weekend weather person, I thought I'd had it made. Live at 5 was this legendary news show. Because it had celebrities on it and lifestyle. It was a groundbreaking show. And I never thought I would be on Live at 5. And one of the great things about Live at 5, they had, if you remember, the legendary studio announcer, Don Pardo.
Oh, yes.
Was their announcer. And the show would start every morning, every night at 5 o'clock with this lightning bolt. And it's at WNBC TV New York. And the music would play. And they would take a shot of Don Pardo in front of one of those old RCA bullet microphones. And he'd have his hand to his ear. He goes, from WNBC TV in New York, this is Live at 5 with Jack Cafferty, Sue Simmons, and Frank Field with the weather. So it's my first time filling in. I mean, before it was December of 1983. I will never forget it. And I'm filling in. And so Frank Field starts, Don Pardo starts it off. And he goes, from WNBC TV in New York, this is Live at 5 with Jack Cafferty, Sue Simmons, and Al Roker with the weather. Well, afterwards, I go up to Frank Field, Don Pardo. I said, Mr. Pardo, I'm a huge fan. And I just wanted to say, it was a real thrill for me to hear you say my name. And he goes, I know, I punched it for you.
That is an amazing story here. We're talking to Al Roker. Now, you when you get to the Today Show, obviously you're delivering content that people want to hear about the weather on a day-to-day basis. But a big part of what you have done over your career and still do is covering weather and other topics out in the element themselves.
Yes.
What do you enjoy most about that, and why do you think it's so important to do that?
Well, And look, there are flip sides to it. There are people who say, well, you tell people don't go outside and yet you're outside. And it's like, well, we want to give you a sense of what's going on. And so I think it's still valuable. And look, I have a healthy sense of self-preservation. I am not going to put myself in harm's way or my crew. If we think it's dangerous, we don't go out.
Right.
But I think there is something exciting about it. I think it's, you know that we have to walk a very fine line between excitement and exploitation, because these are people's homes, their lives, their livelihoods, and it's not meant for consumption for our entertainment,
right.
But it's really for information.
And, well, Jim Cantore says
and so I take
similar.
That seriously.
Yeah, no, I think in a podcast, in episode one of the Weather Geeks podcast, Cantore, we were talking about this as well, and your answer is very consistent with what he talked about, which is it's a messaging. And also, it's interesting, I spoke in Savannah recently, and this question came up, why do the meteorologists go outside in the weather? And there was a hearing impaired colleague that came up to me and said, that is most valuable for those citizens to see. The visual markers are more useful for them, and so they really appreciate that. So I thought that was an interesting.
Yeah, and look, it's a visual medium. That's otherwise we're doing either radio or a podcast. So
right. Yeah, exactly.
I've always, and I'm going to digress here, but you know, there is something about that I love about radio and about the oral medium. I've always every year I co-host the Christmas tree lighting.
Yes.
And there are an array of radio stations covering the tree lighting. And because if you're good at what you do, you paint this picture. And but when we do television and there's severe weather, I think nothing you know, as they say, a picture is worth a thousand words. And to be able to bring the power of an image to people is very valuable.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And clearly with some of what we're facing now going forward in weather and climate, we need to, the messaging is as important as the technology, the weather models, the satellites.
Yeah.
I think. And I want a little bit later in the podcast, I want to talk more with you about what your thoughts are on effective weather communication. But what is there a favorite type of weather over your career that you've enjoyed covering, or something that sort of resonates or sticks out in your mind about something you've covered in the past?
You know, I still, to this day, covering Superstorm Sandy was, awe-inspiring. It really taught you about the power of water, that it will find its own way.
Yes, as we saw in with Katrina and exactly. Harvey and other, water is the most dangerous aspect of these storms.
Absolutely, and to watch, we literally traveled 2,000 miles covering this storm. We started in Key West and we went up to New York and then back down to New Jersey, and back to New York again. And it was probably one of the most frightening moments I've ever had, and one of the most, in a sense, if I can use the word, beautiful things I've ever seen. And that, you know, the morning after we survived a dune collapse and this breach, and walking out at 5 a.m. and looking at this landscape that, you know, we were about half a block away from the beach, and the street and everything around it was covered with about a foot and a half of sand. It looked like under the street lights or under our lights, because there was no power, it looked like snow. And at first it kind of threw me off. I said, oh my gosh, this is all sand that's all come in. And it went back, you know, a good half mile.
Wow.
I've never seen anything like that.
Yeah, I'm trying to visualize that because I've not seen anything like that at all.
You know, I mean, literally seeing parking meters. All you saw was the top of the, you just saw the parking meter. There was no, you couldn't see the pole holding it up.
Oh my goodness. Now.
And, you know, everything underneath was sand.
Seeing all of this, Al, do you, I mean, you're there in New York. I mean, you get around the country. Do you think municipalities, stakeholders, policymakers are understanding or thinking more about sort of weather or even climate in their planning or preparations? Because I know one of the things with Sandy was disruption to the MTA system there, mm-hmm. the subway,
oh, yeah.
and others.
And it could have been a lot worse.
It could have been worse, absolutely. But what are your thoughts on just how we're planning as a society for weather events?
Well, I think some places are better than others. You know, you look at Miami, Miami Beach, and they are going full steam ahead. Because, look, as you know, they experience on a fairly regular basis now sunny day flooding.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so they've got a project going to raise streets, to raise the street levels, to put in all these pumps. I mean, it's funny. The first book I wrote on this kind of topic was Storm of the Century in 1900. And after Galveston got devastated, they put in a massive public works project to literally raise the city level and build that seawall, and which is unfortunately now inadequate. But it's the same thing that's happening now. Some cities are and coastal areas are saying, you know what, we better prepare for this. And others are just blithely going along with a nonstop development along coastlines. 60% of our population in this country live along a coast.
Yeah, absolutely.
And by the way, just because you're not along a coast doesn't mean you will not feel the wrath of some of these systems.
We know that in Atlanta with Irma last year.
Exactly.
My kids were out of school 3 or 4 days because of the inland effects of the decaying Irma. We're talking with Al Roker here on the Weather Geeks podcast.
The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Welcome back to the Weather Geeks podcast. We're talking with Al Roker, and you just heard him talk about some interesting aspects of societal preparation for weather events. I want to pivot now to Al's new book, Ruthless Tide, The Heroes and Villains of the Johnstown Flood, America's Astonishing Gilded Age Disaster. The first thing that came to mind when I saw that you had written this book, Al, is why did you pick this particular weather event?
Well, the last one we did, Storm of the Century, which was the Galveston Hurricane of 1900. And you know, my first thought was, oh, maybe we should do something on Katrina. But, you know, I think it still needs a little more distance. But what I found fascinating about the story of the Johnstown Flood, which took place in 1889, was that it was a man-made environmental disaster, that warnings were ignored, that what would be then the 1% wanted something and they didn't really care about others. And ignoring warnings, ignoring concerns, they went ahead and built this fishing and hunting club, damming up a river and creating an artificial lake that a number of critics said, this is not going to hold. This will flood at some point. It's not if, it's just when.
Just when.
And unfortunately, a storm of epic proportions dumped over 12 inches of rain in a very short period of time. And within a matter of hours, the earthen dam gave way. And 20 million tons of water traveling at upwards of 60 miles per hour with crests of 60 feet or more slammed through the Kanama Valley and killed over, by some estimates, as many as 3,000 people. It's still the deadliest flood, pure flood, in American history.
Yeah, and I think, you know, and I appreciate that you're bringing this to attention, but I still get the sense that many in the American public don't, A, realize that fact that you just mentioned, and also still take for granted just how deadly flooding can be.
Oh,
even
yes.
Today, in a contemporary context, they'll still drive through a flooded road because they got to get their kids.
When
their
I
kid
watch it,
and
you'll stand there and watch these. You know, I've been on remotes where, you know, we've covered flooding, and you see these people pushing through, and they think, "Oh, I've got my SUV," and no idea that, you know, a foot of water, you know, can float a car.
The buoyancy of the tires themselves help with that.
Yeah, you know, they have their own buoyancy. You know,
exactly.
That 6 inches of water traveling at 4 miles per hour can knock you off your feet. Yeah, it's astonishing. But yet people, they just, oh, it's just water. Oh, yeah, I turned it on, I turned it off. Well, when you can't turn it off, it finds its own way. And so this story, I think, is one that changed America's perception of natural disasters. It gave rise to and really cemented the reputation of the Red Cross. Clara Barton, her organization became the organization it is because of the Johnstown Flood.
Oh, wow. That's an interesting fact that I wasn't aware of.
Yeah. I mean, and what was interesting, you know, when you think 1889, and women, of course, were in a sense kind of second-class citizens. But because there was so much chaos, she used that to her advantage and was able to establish, literally tent cities, field hospitals, commissaries, all these things, and was able to do it with ruthless efficiency, and so much so that people were astonished at this organization, and so it really put the Red Cross on the map. And 11 years later, because she was no spring chicken, when she was getting ready to retire, she was actually financed by one of the newspaper magnates to help in the rescue effort and recovery effort of the Galveston hurricane.
Wow. This is just fascinating, the type of thing that you're going to only hear if you talk to or listen in on the Weather Geeks podcast. We're grateful to have Al Roker here with us today. you talk about this particular flood, and make sure you go out there and take a look and read this book, Ruthless Tide. I can't wait to finish taking a look at it myself. You talk about communicating flood threats or extreme weather threats in general. We're in a different age than what the folks were in the Johnstown flood. We have social media now. We have Twitter, Facebook, Snapchat. I don't know how many of those you're on, but I know you're on at least Twitter and Instagram because I follow you there. How do you view communicating these threats using these new techniques and capabilities? I mean, I think they actually have pros and cons in the sense that they're immediate, but I think they could be overutilized. You've got all kinds of people out there getting messages out. We've got a system out as we're taping now. There's a system out in the Gulf of Mexico, yep. And I'm seeing all kinds of people tweeting and talking about it.
And that's the problem. There's no.
What are your thoughts?
As I tell my kids, I've got a daughter, 31. I've got another daughter who's 19, and I've got a son who's about to turn 16. And I tell them, just because it's on the internet doesn't mean it's true. Just because it comes across your feed on your phone doesn't mean it's true. Do you know the source? Can you trust the source? And I think that's where, whether it's an NBC News or a Weather Channel, I mean, people know that they can trust what we're going to say. In Ruthless Tide, we talk about how, thanks to this, to one courageous telegraph operator who remained at her post, even though she knew the flood was coming, she kept sending out messages down the line and down the valley so that people knew what was coming. But unfortunately, once it got to the end in Johnstown, how did you disseminate it? How did you get and by the time they got the message, it was too late. This thing was roaring toward them.
Wow.
When I kind of sat down after finishing it, I was just floored. I worked with a terrific research guy by the name of Bill Hoagland. And when I looked at what he put together, and I thought, my God, what this was must have been like for that era. I mean, something that was, if you can picture, it's called one newspaper called it an unleashed monster.
Yes.
This thing was traveling, and because of the geography of the valley, it came to it was like a funnel and pushed to a point to where Johnstown was. So the water started, kept rising and, you know, gained in speed, and it was literally taking out locomotives, steel foundries, barbed wire companies. I mean, homes, businesses, so that by the time it got to Johnstown, it had literally boiling ore, iron ore in it. It had locomotives. It had train cars. It's hard to even fathom what this was when it slammed into Johnstown.
Yes. And that's, I think that's an interesting part of the story here to just understand, one, the power, sheer power and force of the water, but all of these other aspects of the flood, the other debris. And I particularly appreciate your story about the human element there in the warning, because it reminded me a lot of Gary Sitkowski there at the New Jersey Mount Holly Weather Service office during Sandy, we were talking about early, and how he was sort of making these desperate pleas. And we dealt with this topic on the television version of Weather Geeks, because there were some that say that the human element in meteorological and weather forecasting and warnings is going to go away. And I think your story suggests that that's just not likely to happen.
Well, I don't think it's likely, nor should it, because, you know, you can have all the automation you want, but, you know, at the end of the day, meteorology is as much an art as it is a science.
Yes.
Gut reaction, gut feelings, the human element. You take it out. Yes, you can. I mean, look, that's part of the problem with a lot of these apps. They're algorithms and formulas.
Yes, yes. Speak on this, please, because the app, what I call atmospheric science, everyone sort of, I still think about people that are pulling up their apps. I think about a particular sports team that the manager was looking at their app, and they decided not to close the retractable roof on their stadium. This app thing has become a problem. Now, they're useful, so I don't want to bash.
Listen.
But the context
on an average day or whatever, that's fine. But when it comes down to critical thinking and intuiting, an app's not going to get it.
Yeah, I agree. And in a rapidly evolving weather situation as well, whether it be a severe storm or a landfalling hurricane, I really appreciate that you really emphasize that point. We're talking with Al Roker here on Weather Geeks Podcast. I want to shift the gears here because a lot of people may not realize this about you, Al, that your interests are varied. I mean, you've made cameos in Sharknado, Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs. Is that cool to you or just another part of the job of sort of making sure you're sort of getting word out and being exposed in different arenas?
Well, look, if it gets to the point where I don't sit back and go, wow, I got to do that, then it's time to get out. I love what I do. I mean, I got to tell you, I'm sitting here right now, here in New York. We're at the legacy radio stations, not just in New York City, but in America, WOR. I mean, this thing has so much history. So I appreciate that. When I walk into 30 Rockefeller Plaza, there is no other building like it in the world that is a temple to broadcasting that was built specifically for radio and then television. I still look up at the murals on the ceilings and on the walls. I enjoy the terracotta floors, the terrazzo floors, I should say. I mean, the idea that I'm holding a book that I wrote is still amazing to me. My parents are gone now, and my mother was a voracious reader. And when my first book came out, the smile on her face was everything. That her boy wrote a book.
Yes.
That somebody was going to buy. And you know, even something as goofy as like having some millennial come up to me and said, I saw you, I used to watch you when you were a character on The Proud Family. That's kind of cool.
It's cool. I mean, that's right. I think that, the most successful people are the people that don't feel like they're working. That's just been my experience over my years. I mean, the ones that aren't saying, thank God it's Friday, but just saying, wow, no. When can I do what I do again? And so you've been involved in comic books. Rumor has it, and following you a little bit on Instagram, that you're a foodie or in the food.
I do like to cook. I have two cookbooks. I enjoy cooking. I'm one of those people that wakes up thinking, what am I making for dinner?
Oh, wow.
You know,
not my wife would like you.
You know, so I love it. I just came back from Vancouver. I've always been interested. I when I was 8 years old, I read my first Sherlock Holmes short story. And I remember thinking, oh, man, I love this. And my mom was a big mystery thriller reader, and I've always wanted to write murder mystery, and I've written three of them called The Morning Show Mysteries, and Hallmark is producing them. I'm producing them and co-wrote them, and I just came back from Vancouver where we just finished filming the second movie.
Oh, wow.
And so
when can we expect the
well, it'll be on sometime in July.
Okay.
Starring Holly Robinson Pete and Rick Fox.
Nice. So. Make sure you check these out. I look forward to them as well. What about what is it like, Al, to start the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade?
Yeah, it is. I like to consider myself Mr. Holiday because I get to take part in three of what I would say are the quintessential holiday rituals that are broadcast. I've been doing the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade now for 22 years.
Grew up watching it all that time.
I do the Christmas tree, the Rockefeller Center Christmas tree lighting. I've been doing that. This was before it was even a network show. It was a local broadcast here in New York. And I started doing that in December of 1984. And I do the Rose Parade.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah. And so the idea, I mean, I used to, part of my family tradition, like millions of Americans, was to get up in the morning on Thanksgiving. You're still in your pajamas. You're watching the Thanksgiving Day Parade. You can smell the turkeys is cooking. And in New York, when the parade was over, you switched over to Channel 11 and you watched Laurel and Hardy and March of the Wooden Soldiers. And that was our Thanksgiving. And the idea that people have grown up watching me do this and be part of their Thanksgiving is such an honor. You know, it still And my kids have been on floats. My little girl was a Christmas tree on the Santa float. 1 year, another year, she was a present. She was like, you know, she was like a gift wrapped box, you know. And I just can't say enough about it. You know, to be on the Upper West Side when those balloons, when you hear the guy, the parade marshal go, Snoopy, please join the parade. And all of a sudden around the corner on 77th Street comes this giant Snoopy. And while it's great on TV, to be there when it fills your field of vision, because on TV, there's a natural border. You know, so that, but when you are on, and I urge everybody, every American listening, that at some point you've got to come to the Macy's Thanksgiving Day Parade and watch this. It is, you will be transformed to a child again.
That's what I've heard. I've heard it's one of those kind of see the Grand Canyon moments to
yes.
go to the Macy's.
Yeah,
Parade.
A little different. I've seen the Grand Canyon, and they are two different things. In fact, I proposed to my wife on the south rim of the Grand Canyon.
Oh, wow.
And I had hosted the Fiesta Bowl parade for NBC when we carried it. And I thought, you know what? This is the place. And we went, and I said, I want to propose next year. On the rim, south rim of the Grand Canyon. I figured it would be, first, it would be gorgeous. I wanted to do it at sunset. And two, it would be efficient because if she said no, only one of us was coming back. I'm not saying who, but it lucked out.
I think it all worked out. I mean, for those that don't know, his wife is Deborah Roberts, a legendary journalist in her own right.
Yes. In fact, we are going to be both covering the royal wedding. She's doing it for ABC, and our daughter, who is in school in Paris, is going to be her intern, which I'm a little ticked about because it's like, why did you choose mom?
I got kids. You know how that goes. I want to bring it to a close here. Really appreciate the conversation. I hope you've enjoyed this in-depth dive with Al Roker. Just in this last few minutes or so, I mean, you've been such an inspiration for so many in terms of what you do, coming into their homes each day, even for those that, you know, just a representative of the various groups that may not necessarily be represented on TV. I think a lot of people looked up to you from that regard. What do you consider as your sort of legacy from the past and going forward?
I guess my feeling is I would like to think that I haven't wasted anybody's time, and B, that if the time spent with me, whether it was on the Weather Channel or whether it's on the Today Show, that hopefully they feel a little bit better when they turn off the TV than before they turned it on. And if I've informed them and helped them get to their day and make them smile just a little bit, then I think that's a good thing to have been known for.
And there you have it from Al Roker, America's weatherman, NBC, and certainly someone that has been an inspiration in my career. You know, as an African-American meteorologist, I certainly have looked up to you in terms of what you've been able to do. So I just want to take this opportunity to personally thank you from afar, and thank you for joining us on the Weather Geeks podcast.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity and also the chance to talk about this book, Ruthless Tide, because I just am so very, very proud of it. It reads like a movie, but it's all true. And the other thing is that this could happen again. That if we are not careful, if we do not pay attention to environmental rules being relaxed, changes being made without proper vetting. That we could see another environmental disaster on this scale. It can happen again.
Absolutely. Weather Geeks listeners, please go out there and get a copy of Ruthless Tide. I'm sure it's available at all of the places where you can get the bestsellers. And make sure you're also following Al Roker and all of his social media. Al, what's your Twitter handle?
Twitter and Instagram at Al Roker.
Okay, so follow him, and also be sure to follow Weather Geeks as well. We have a new Twitter handle at Weather Geeks, WEATHERGEEKS. Thank you for joining us on the Weather Geeks podcast.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com.